Accession number 27185, reel 48.
Major Barras, reel 48. You were saying you felt a slight sense of guilt that you were heading away from where you thought the trouble was going to be when you set off for Jamaica.
Yes, but I think, as I mentioned, it was the actual numbers employed in Korea from the British Army was only a brigade size. So there obviously wasn't room for an awful lot of people, and as I said earlier, that if they'd wanted me there, then I would go. But I think that was the attitude of everybody. But on the other hand, I didn't know what to expect in the Caribbean and Jamaica. I mean, obviously, we're going in the wrong way, or what I thought was the wrong way. But it did look like a bit of a backwater, and I had slight qualms about it. And I thought, it must be something in it, because otherwise, having offered me G2 of a Commonwealth division, they wouldn't suddenly say, well, we'll shove him somewhere where it doesn't matter. So I had to wait and see. But the old banana boat was a very antiquated, it was about 30 years old, I think. And I remember going into the cabin, which I had to myself, and there was a sort of four-poster bed in there with sort of brass knobs on, which rattled the whole time we went. We sailed along, but I can't remember how many people. There weren't an awful lot, 70 at the absolute outside in the way of passengers. They were mixed, as I said before. There were a number of Jamaicans there, and this was my first contact, or my first sight of Jamaicans. And it's my first indication of how boisterous they were, with laughing and talking and so forth. And of course, they were so different from the ones people I've been used to in the Far East and Middle East, Arabs and Indians and Burmese, who are much more reserved and quiet. But then could get, especially the Indians and the Arabs, could get very angry. And that's when they weren't quiet, and everybody had to look out. But these seemed a good-humoured lot. But they were pretty noisy lot, especially when they'd had a few rums and at the bar, but no one ever got drunk or anything like that, or abusive or anything. They were just very good human, and that was their way. And of course, I couldn't understand too much what they were saying. Now, of course, we know the Jamaican accent very well because we hear it on the television and radio. But of course, they got their own patois, which they use, which you have to pick up when you're living there, and then you understand what they're talking about. So there they were. We started off, we sailed eventually. I don't think it was too long there. I restrained myself from asking the captain whether we were taking back empty banana skins for refills. Crossed my mind. I don't know what they were taking out, actually. I suppose commercial stuff. But coming back, we're filled with bananas, obviously. On the trip, there are one or two things I remember. The first thing I remember was the first, either the first night or the second night out. We saw a great big line of lights on the horizon coming towards us on the starboard side, I think it was. And everybody was called on the deck, and we watched this line of lights approach quite some speed, about a mile off, I suppose. And as it drew level with us, there must have been some radio signal between the two. Suddenly, there were three red funnels with floodlit, and sort of hovering in the sky for about seven or eight seconds, and then it went out. And it was obviously the Queen Mary. But it's the sort of sight that you can see, and I can see it now. And it swept off down into the darkness behind us and was gone. That's obviously on its way from New York to London. The next were the other things we saw on the way. I remember we saw a school of whales, not far off us, actually. They didn't seem to be in any hurry to go anywhere. There were sort of quite a lot of them. Tails flashing in the air and spouting. It was novel for us to look at, anyway. And then we have one or two water spouts in the distance, small ones, small thin ones. But we got some squalls, and the weather was not too bad, actually. It got warmer, of course, the further south we went, chugging along. We got some very heavy rain squalls now and again. The sort of dark blue clouds would suddenly loom up and cover the sky, and rain would pour down, then they'd disappear again, the sun would come out as if nothing had happened. And the last thing I think I remember seeing was the salt pyramids of the Caicos and Turks and Caicos Islands. We couldn't see the islands, we could just see the tops of the salt pyramids above the horizon, so to speak. And then one night we passed Cuba, and the following morning we docked at Kingston in Jamaica.
What were your first impressions of Kingston when you went ashore?
Well, when I got there, I put on my KD service dress for the first time. Well, I've tried it on. Long trousers. And I went out on deck, and I was suddenly hit by the heat, because it was July. And downtown Jamaica, Kingston, was very hot, most stuffy most of the year. Got off, we went through this big warehouse, so that was heat, hot, called a godown where the luggage was, and I was met by Major John Sale, who I was relieving there. I can't remember his regiment. And he used his influence in the shed, and we were off, and he got the staff car outside. And we drove off, and then we went through Kingston. That was my first sight of anything worth looking at there. It seemed a lovely place. We went down King Street, which with all the shops, department stores, the tree-lined. It was well kept, clean, and everybody was going about their business in an orderly way. It was very hot, I remember. And then we went behind Kingston, up behind the back, towards the hills, the mountains. We didn't get as far as that, to the Up Park Camp. Now, Up Park Camp was situated, as I say, well behind Kingston. It was on higher ground, and it contained everything which was, almost everything which was belonged to the military garrison. Our headquarters was in there, married quarters were in there, there was the officers' club, sergeants' club, the NAFE canteens, and there were big playing fields there with grandstands and so forth. In fact, the whole thing was self-contained, and it was surrounded by a fence with two gates. I think there were two gates which you had to come through, but you had to have a pass to get in. So I was driven in there, and I was so struck with this Up Park Camp. It was more of a park, really. There was these beautiful, so well kept. There were tarmac roads and paths around the place. There were bushes and trees with these flamboyant, beautiful flowers, a canna and a frangipani. What were the others? Bougainvillea, hibiscus, and all that. Lovely, beautiful flowers. It was a beautifully kept park. And I was driven to the AQMG's quarters, married quarters. Lieutenant Colonel Laurie Sheldon and his wife, Rosemary. And they were going to put me up for a few days until a place could be found for me in the local club, where I was going to stay permanently, because there was no mess, there was no headquarters mess. The only alternative would be to put me in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers mess, who were the battalion there, but that wouldn't have worked very well to have a staff officer from headquarters in there. So I stayed here with the Sheldons, and he was from Devons, I think, Devonshire Regiment. They were a delightful couple. He was totally unconscious of his rank. But at the same time, he commanded some respect, and you could talk to him just like anybody else. I mean, he was so laid back. And his wife, Rosemary, I remember, had a mind of her own, but she was very jokey with it. She was quite a lady. But I think this was his second marriage. I think they didn't have any children. He had children from his previous marriage. He used to come out and stay with him. Sorry, you were just about to...
So to ask you what this club was. Was it a military club?
Well,
or was it
the, after I'd been
well?
There... No, it was a civilian club. Mm. And after I'd been there for... I think it was about 3 or 4 days, a room became vacant for me. That is a bedroom. Because the club itself was had... Most of its members were sort of ordinary, sort of casual people who came in and had a drink, played tennis. There were tennis courts at the back, or came in just to play cards. There was a card room there. And then upstairs, there were about half a dozen bedrooms for residents, and I was allocated one of these. The club itself was a fairly newish building. It was just a sort of oblong square thing with I remember the dining room downstairs was open one side to where the back side towards the tennis courts. But it was a situation that it was situated off the main road into Kingston. You had to go through a drive through trees to get to it. And then out of the back were all the tennis courts. And then there was the race course, Kingston race course, beyond that. And then the mountains beyond that. And from where I was in my bedroom upstairs, I had a balcony, and I could sit on this balcony, and I had this beautiful view right across behind. I mean, I never had it so good, I suppose, they would say. And I had all my meals there. And the members were mixed. There was no proper colour bar in Jamaica at all, and that I found throughout the whole of the West Indies, except in Barbados, where there was a bit of a colour bar there. They had the yacht club there, where definitely blacks were not allowed in. But this had a mixture of local Jamaicans, and of course they went through all the colours of the rainbow. Really, I mean, if you were European, you were pale when you first went there. And then you had the right at the other end of the scale, really black Jamaican. But of course, they didn't need to have a colour. I mean, they've been living together for 300 years, and there've been mixed marriages and mixed births, which didn't necessarily result the result of a marriage. And so there were all kinds of colours. And I think what it boiled down to was, if you had the money and the influence, you just worked your way in. And the relationship with the Jamaicans there was excellent. I mean, the staff car, which came for me, for instance, it was a Humber Sniper, I remember, was camouflaged for some reason. So it could disappear, I suppose. With a delightful driver, Samuels. He was to be my driver for the whole time I was there. He was totally reliable, great sense of humour, had a family of which he was very proud, and I remember whilst I was there he became a Lance Corporal, which I was very pleased to hear he got, and he came from the RASC. Now, all the people who worked for us were rather the same sort of attitude. So I didn't come across any colour problems in Jamaica at all. I think they're more relevant here in the UK than they were out there, actually.
Could well be, because in the United Kingdom people were not used to mixing.
Well, that's right.
On the same basis.
Yeah. But as soon as the slaves got their independence, of course, a lot of them stayed on. And I suppose they had mixed fortunes, but a lot of them, I mean, some of them were even titled. I mean, there was Sir somebody and Lady Barker, I remember, who were black. A lot of them had companies, a lot of them were barristers, a lot of them were working in the civil service. There was a chap there, which I'll come on to later in my work, but I used to work with the Jamaica government there, a little chap called Souter, who was a civil servant, local chap. Brilliant little man. I say little because he was small, but We used to work together very well. No problems at all. Suppose the next thing I would have to say is I went to talk about when I go and take over, when I took over rather from John Sale. The office was a small building because there were few of us. It was a brick building at the back of the up park camp. My office, I remember, was at the back of the building, but I had a straight view, straight through the other offices, with all the windows and doors open, out on the balcony in the front there, right over the playing fields in front, right over the top of Kingston, which you could barely see because it was down in the dip, out to the sparkling blue Caribbean. And with the window open behind me, I got a lovely gentle breeze through there, and it was probably the best office I've ever had. How I ever got any work done, I don't know, because the view out there was stupendous. Except, of course, when the storms came and it rained, then we had to batten everything down and it got stuffy. So, anyway, I took over from John Sale.
And this was headquarters for the whole Caribbean?
Headquarters Caribbean area, yeah. Now, the other people working in the office, I had a brigadier. My boss was Brigadier Jackson. He had his office next to mine. I reported directly to him.
Was he the G1 then?
No, he was the brigadier.
Yes.
Brigadier commander of the area.
Ah, so it was a brigade command.
It was a brigade command, yes. There was nothing between me and him. And I had no staff of my own. I had no G3s at all or anything. But I worked with there was a sort of communal clerks pool, so to speak, typists, which was headed up by a warrant officer, male warrant officer, from the Pay Corps, I think. I don't know RSC, I think, probably. And then there were typists in there and clerks, mostly RAC, WRAC, or local families had produced people. I remember a couple of them were civilians who came in and took shorthand typing. And they belonged to army families. I don't think at that time we employed anybody from outside, because a lot of our work was confidential, obviously, for being in a colony, surrounded by colonies. The old brig was he'd been in the Royal Hampshires. He had done some, he'd been brigadier administration, I think, in East Africa. So he was well versed in colonial administration. He was a wise old bird. He had a very dry sense of humour. He was, I suppose, in his 50s. He grey. About my height. He had one of those faces which never seemed to tan, sort of pale, sort of dry-looking skin, with pale blue eyes that looked out through glasses at one. I think he was regarded by the local community as being a bit of a dry old stick, but he wasn't at all. He just didn't have time for small talk. He didn't suffer fools too gladly. But I found him easy to work for. He was very sharp, in fact, and he was very good on the political side. He understood what was going on. He used to be very clear in his instructions to me. He was very supportive. He was helpful. If I could always go to him and chat with him. And we got on. Well, from my point of view, I got on well with him. I don't think he ever gave me much impression that he found me a bit of a bore, but perhaps he did on times, I don't know. If he did, he kept it to himself. And then there was the AQMG, who was Laurie Sheldon, who I mentioned before, who had all the administrative side, because there were married families there. And I'll come on to the size of the garrison in a minute, because it's quite large, actually, compared with the place. He had two star captains. One was A, adjutants, and one was Q, quartermasters. One was Captain Laurie Sharp, I remember, who was Royal Engineers, who was married to a Greek lady, And the other one was from the Royal Irish Fusiliers, who had been there, and he'd been left behind. And he was married. He was a Roman Catholic, George. He was a great character. George Mary Semple, his name was. And he was married to another Irish girl, and they had a big family. And he was enormous fun. And that was all we had, really.
What was your role then as G2? What was the scope of your...
Well, I had so much, I mean, everything to do with general staff and more. I had operations, I had training, intelligence, SD, ceremonial, and then I had all kinds of other little sort of side things, like being chairman of the local football military league. I found there was a cycling club there too, which I was supposed to have meetings on. And then there were all kinds of things I had to do, like there were courtesy calls from the US Navy, Royal Navy, and I used to have to put my white uniform sword and go down and call on them, and they come back and call on us. Because calling on a US ship at that time, they were dry. So you sat there and chatted to the captain, and we went aboard. You whistled as you went up the bosun into the captain's cabin, and then you were served with ice cream and coffee. Well, they were a cheery lot. We had a lot of... sometimes they come back again and remember each other. Mm. And of course, when the Royal Navy came in, then you had pink gin. So there was no problem there very much.
What did you give the Americans when they called on you?
Oh, we took them to the club, because we didn't have any sort of other mess or anything. We took them to the officers' club and gave them alcohol, which they drank down gratefully. And of course, ships used to come in there for rest and recreation. And they pull into Kingston, and they come ashore. They come through, they get a jetty there, which was near the... there was a big hotel there. It was... The nickname was Turtle Club. Can't remember its proper name, doesn't matter. Anyway, they used to come through that hotel and then go off into the town. And all the sort of ladies of the town used to get ready for them, and with bars and everything, with put flags out, stars and stripes. And of course, they're not used to drink. A lot of them used to come back up, so they'd rotten to the eyebrows. And if you were down at this hotel at all, because you could sit outside, there were big areas outside with tables and little lights and things you could sit under. You find a lot of these characters lying in the grass there, waiting to be picked up. And of course, these military police, the American military police, with their white helmets and a truncheon, would come along and pick these guys up and drag them off down to the jetty, where they'd go on a sort of liberty boat out to the ship, probably moored out. But they weren't all like that. I mean, some of them were. Most of them were perfectly sober when they went back. But I can remember once sitting there, and a chap came up, and there was a woman sitting at the table, and there was a guy lying in the grass not far away, and one of the American military police came up and called across to the woman, saying, is this man annoying you, ma'am? She said, no, not a bit. So he picked him up and hit him on the head with a truncheon and took him off. As if he wasn't out enough already.
It seems a bit surplus to requirements.
Well, yes, exactly, yes. The jobs, well, you know, when you come to sort of analyse them, or perhaps I should give you some idea what the garrison consisted of, because that's what my job, and also the area which we covered. There was one British service battalion stationed there always, and on this occasion it was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, whose barracks were just behind us inside our park camp. They were near enough for us to hear the bugle calls throughout the day, so remind us that we were still soldiers. And as we said, far enough away not to get the whiff of Billy the Goat, which was Their mascot, yes. Yeah. So they were there. There was the other battalion was the Jamaica battalion, and that was stationed out near the airport, what was called Palisados. There was a thin neck of land that used to go, but it still does, obviously, ran out from the mainland and curved round, so it embraced a whole stretch of water between the mainland and this sort of stretch of land going out. And then it broadened out to about a mile, mile and a half, and on that area were the airport and also the Jamaica Battalion barracks. Then it went on to Port Royal, where Captain Morgan used to preside. And that stopped there, and then there was a gap between that and the mainland where the ships used to come in and out, go in and out. And they were out in the out in these barracks. They were very good. They had a British CO, Colonel Barnaby, I remember, and they had all but one company commanders were British. The other one was Jamaican, David Smith, who was very good. In fact, he came back to England for the Queen's coronation to represent the Jamaican contingent, or to command the Jamaican contingent. And was later, I heard when we went back there later, he became chief of the general staff, or whatever he called him, of the Jamaica forces, and retired. So he was the Jamaican company commander. The second in command was British. The RSM was British. Ex-Guards, RSM, Coldstream, I think. Coldstream seemed to get around, didn't they, and other people's units. And then there was a number of WOs and sergeants, who were especially the technical ones, which were British as well. And as you would expect with an RSM from the Guards, their drill was excellent. They could pick and choose their recruits, so they were all pretty sort of the same size. And they were well drilled and a pretty efficient lot, by and large. The CO, talking of COs, CO of the Royal Welshshire member was Colonel Johnson. Can't remember his first name. He was got a DSO. He obviously commanded a battalion in the war. He was an Australian, although he wouldn't. He was born in Australia, put it that way. Although you didn't get the impression from his accent that he'd been recently there, or was from Australia. He was married to the daughter of Admiral Keyes of Gallipoli memory. And he was one of the ones who, in the House of Commons, was responsible for getting Churchill back into power, and made him Prime Minister, rather. Anyway, he was respected. I wouldn't say chaps had an awful lot of affection for him. He was a bit brash and over the top, but he was very efficient, I think. But I don't think he had much time for people's foibles, put it that way. but he was a good CO. Same as Barnaby. So we had two good COs there. There were a lot of services. There was the RESC, which was commanded by a major, but these were all locals. They were local services. They weren't British service. They were all local. So the RESC was mostly manned by Jamaicans, or anybody else for that matter, who may have been other Caribbean islands. And that was commanded by a major. Then there was the Royal Engineers, which were mostly work services, which had a lieutenant colonel in charge, a CRE. Then there was the REMC, which also had a lieutenant colonel, ADMS, because he was also OC of the hospital there. There was a military hospital there. Then there was REMI, Royal Signals, which was had a special section with it to operate a radio, which we kept in touch with the Navy, with the Americans. That was it, I think, as far as the radio was concerned. And if we sent, we had nobody outside.